You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton for the stay.
Welcome, 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 friend. I'm TK, your tour guide to the past, and you are listening to For the Love of History, the podcast where we talk about world history, women's history, and weird history. Welcome. If you are watching on YouTube, you will notice, hey, this isn't TK's usual background. Nay, nay, dear one, it is not. I am at my in-laws right now, and the filming schedule cannot be changed. I'm dog-sitting right now, so that's why we're here. If you're listening only on the podcast, you have no idea what I'm talking about and you are living in ignorant bliss, and that's fine. It's wonderful. Anyways, it's almost the end of March, my friend, and I love March for a few reasons. The number one being that there's five Fridays in March, which means that we can have five episodes in 1 month, which we're just a bunch of lucky little duckies. So today we are ending Women's History Month with a women's history topic. I finally got a royalty-free air horn. How exciting was that? I feel like I will abuse my newfound power if I do not consciously make an effort to restrain myself, because with great air horn comes great responsibility. And I will do my best to wield my air horn with semi-responsibility. I feel so powerful. Anyway, today we're gonna talk about some more women who had the power, some women who were moral lessons, and some women who ate people. I bet you didn't think we're gonna talk about cannibals when you clicked on this episode, but here we are. However, before we do any of that, let's get our housekeeping out of the way. So first on the docket, the fourth anniversary of For the Love of History podcast is next week, April 1st, which is bananas. We have officially made it past the 3-year life expectancy of many podcasts. And I feel so lucky that you're here to spend it with me. I just really appreciate you. And we'll be doing some extra special things. First, a live recording of next week's episode. The live recording will be with me on Thursday evening, US time next week, and I will be uploading regularly on Friday. So if you'd like to watch the live recording and you want to know what specific time it will be in your time zone, you can head to the link in the show notes and set alert notifications to the YouTube live event that I have made on there. So yeah, you can get all your answers questioned, absolutely not, all your questions answered in the show notes for that. Second order of business is, if you haven't already, what are you doing? Subscribe to the YouTube channel. Super helpful. Great free 99 way to help the podcast. Third order of business is, third and final, is we will also be doing a live history quiz game to celebrate 4 years of For the Love of History. And all of the information for that is also in the show notes. But just to give you a quick little what's up, we will be doing a live game. You're going to be answering in. I'm going to make some questions. We're going to have some fun. It's going to be really exciting. So if you want to participate in that, you can sign up for it using the form linked in the show notes. How many times have I said show notes? And we're not even like 5 minutes into the podcast. But I guess it is the only time that I say show notes. That and the ending. Anyways, that does it for the housekeeping, so let's jump into the episode. Like I said, we are finishing the month of March off with a women's history topic and mythology topic, so it's a double whammy. Today we are going to hop into the time machine that has magically been turned into a sailboat for us to venture around the many women-only islands that we are going to talk about today. So grab a flotation device and your choice of a sharp pointy thing to keep away the demons and the people that are gonna eat you, and let's get to it. an island shrouded in mist, populated solely by women. Depending on the welcome a visitor would receive, it would be a paradise or an absolute nightmare. One of my first introductions to the idea of an island inhabited only by women is probably similar to many out there, and maybe even yours, my delicious little donut, Wonder Woman and the Amazons. When my brother got a very chunky DC encyclopedia for his birthday, I believe it was, we would spend hours looking in the book, deciding which superhero would be on our team. I was so excited when I saw the full two-page spread of Wonder Woman and learned about her home with the other Amazons. They were everything that I wanted to be. They were cool, they were pretty, they were riding horses, they had awesome accessories, and they kicked ass wherever they went. I spent many hours playing pretend that I was best friends with Wonder Woman, and we would fight crime in the backyard along with the fairies that were also there and the griffin that just so happened to be an old tree trunk that had been chopped down, but I digress. I loved everything about the idea of an island full of women until I got into high school and was introduced to Homer and his impossibly long odyssey. Apparently, DC wasn't the first to come up with the idea of a woman-only island. Research for this episode led me on a very interesting path, one that I didn't expect in the slightest, but I'm really excited to take you on this adventure with me. Through my research, I discovered that the idea of an island of maidens can sometimes have a sinister side. So let's start with a fan favorite, the inspiration for this episode, the Amazon women of Themiscira. The first appearance of a group of women warriors in Greek mythology comes from the writings of Herodotus in the 5th century, but we don't really get a clear picture of them from his writings, so we're going to say thank you, Herodotus, and move our little time machine to the 7th or 8th century, because we don't know exactly when good old Homer, not the yellow guy from the TV show, but the history guy in a toga, wrote the Iliad and the Odyssey. Homer is like a super weird guy, and at the time he was writing his big hero's journey, the Iliad and the Odyssey, the rights of Greek women were in the negative. They were in the red. But in the Iliad, he talks about incredibly strong warrior women, the Amazons, who only left their island to fight the heroes of old and only invited men to their island when they needed to make more warriors, if you know what I mean. In Homer's Iliad, they fight on the side of Troy, and their queen, Penthesilea, does battle with Achilles, and she unfortunately loses but is returned to her soldiers to be properly buried. From there, stories and lore about the Amazons and their secret island grew and grew. For thousands of years, we only saw Amazon through the lens of men. In fact, the oldest book that I could find, written by a woman, that was only about the Amazons and not mixed in with other mythology, came out in the 2000s, and it's called Warrior Women: An Archaeologist's Search for History's Hidden Heroes, published on February 1st, 2003. But if you know of any older ones, please, please, please tell me I'm wrong. I want to be wrong. I want there to be older books that came out earlier that were about the Amazons that were written by women. And I will make a correction in the show notes. So if I'm wrong, send me an email, send me a message. Let a girl know, but I will digress. Nonetheless, these men of history wrote a ton about these warrior women and their island. According to their legends, the island was a paradise, a place where women trained for battle from the time that they could walk and hold a sword at the same time. They based their society on equality and were completely self-sufficient, aside from the occasional need for procreation. In Greek art, they were depicted as strong, tall warriors with muscular bodies from years of training. And you know what? I'm going to give the Greek authors and historians a little tiny baby brownie point for not sexualizing these Amazonian warriors until you get to this freaking weirdo. Helen Nikos Hellenikos. Hellenikos. H-E-L-L-A-N-I-K-O-S. Because this guy had an absolutely wild theory about the origin of the name Amazon. So the name Amazonas was not originally a Greek word, and Greek scholars were trying to figure out what it means. And Hellenikos said, "Do you know what I think it has to do with boobies? Boobaloobaloobies, okay?" And all the other Greek historians were like, "Hellenikos, like, get out, go home, you're drunk." But Hellenikos was like, no, listen. Hear me out, okay? So we have this word, a foreign loan word, okay? Right? It's a prefix, and it means without. And the word mazons kind of sounds like the Greek word for breasts. Therefore, Amazons means without boobaloobies. And the other historians were like, Hellenikos, like, you write good history, my friend, but what in the world are you talking about? They rejected this idea. However, this idea stuck around for a ridiculously long time and turned into this myth about how the Amazons cut off one of their breasts to be better at archery, which is such a wild thing to say. Like, what? Talk to any archer with boobies today and they're gonna tell you that tatas are not the thing that's holding them back in archery. Secret, secret time. It's misogyny. Just secret between you and me, okay? For the most part, the legendary Amazons were autonomous, only inviting men in to make other warrior women. But as more legends about them were created, their stories took on a more sinister vibe. They allegedly killed or mutated male babies, took men and enslaved them, and they were ruthless and unforgiving. But despite this, they were always bested in battle by Greek men, which many scholars believe to be a moral lesson about the troubles of not following Greek gender roles. No matter how hard the women tried, they could train their whole lives to be elite warriors, but in the end, they would never beat a man. But this is just the beginning of the moral lessons that we will encounter today, dear one. The Amazons weren't the only island women in Greek mythology. Homer was like a little bit obsessed with the idea and wrote about three other islands of women in the Odyssey. There's a fantastic paper about the relationship between women and islands in literature written by Marina Dieru. I'll leave it in the show notes. I definitely recommend giving it a read because it really adds another layer to this whole idea of an island of maidens. So go check that out. But we don't have time for that today. So just like Odysseus did, we must now hop into our time boat and sail to the next island. Greek mythology has a silly, goofy way of punishing women and goddesses for doing the exact same thing men and gods do. A favorite punishment among the gods is banishment to an island, especially the piece of garbage Zeus. He loves doing that. And in the Odyssey, Odysseus just so happens to stumble upon the island of Ogygia, where the nymph Calypso has been banished because she sided with her daddy Atlas and the Titans, and Zeus got all pissy about it and sent her to this island because she was a bad girl. Calypso had been on this island for a hot minute when all of a sudden she saw a man drowning in the water and she decided to go save him. And she did. She saved him, and that man was Odysseus. She brought him to her island and immediately fell in love with him, and Odysseus fell in love with her, although possibly with the help of a little bit of magic. Just a little bit of magic, okay? He stayed with her for many years, which is exactly what Calypso wanted, but unfortunately for her, she was written into this story as not a main character, but a moral lesson. She represented the easy life, a life of luxury, of lavishness, but in the end, no legacy. And Odysseus needed a legacy. So he needed to pick up his responsibilities and go back to his dutiful wife who had been living on her own and waiting for him, chased and all that stuff, whatever. And he needed to be a hero. So he had to leave. Odysseus was very upset because after living for 7 years with Calypso and sharing horizontal late night activities with her and being waited on hand and foot and having his every whim and need met, Calypso was like, I don't want you to leave. I love you. I thought you loved me. And he was like, no, Calypso, get out of my face. I don't want you anymore. And then she said, well, then you have to stay here. And Odysseus was like, no. And Athena saw this. And Athena, who is definitely not a girl's girl, went to Zeus and asked him, begged him to force Calypso to release Odysseus, which he agreed to. And he sent Hermes to do his dirty work. Odysseus left. Calypso was very sad, but Odysseus had another island to run into. And on this island was Circe, who had also been banished for admitting her witchcraft powers. Powers which her brother also had. And when her dad, Helios, found out about her brother's witchcraft powers, he gave him a whole freaking kingdom because he was like, this is really cool. Good job, son. But my daughter, no, absolutely not, Circe. To the island you go. And she was banished there. Cool. Odysseus, being the world's worst navigator, stumbled across Circe's island. And after a long time at sea, the lush greenery of Aea was a welcome relief from the wind and waves. Some of his men, once reaching shore, went to go scout the area, and that's when they found the witch, Circe, who turned them into a bunch of pigs. But one guy was able to escape, and he went back and warned Odysseus. And then that sneaky little snake, Hermes, came along, and he was like, bro, let me give you some advice and also some magic to counteract Circe's magic. Odysseus was like, thank you for the solid, bro. Really appreciate it. And then he made his way up to Circe's house. And long story short, he bamboozled her. He got information out of her. And he also slept with her without being overcome by her magic. And here, Homer slips in another moral lesson. Circe's story is a warning to men about the power of femininity and the power that women have to disrupt the structure of society with sex and magic. Odysseus escapes the island, but has one more little adventure in morality to overcome the sirens. In Homer's story, the sirens are described as women who are half women and half bird with beautiful but deadly voices. There is a lot of misinformation about what a siren is and what they do. The first is that they are cannibals, but there's no mention of the sirens actually eating the sailors that crash upon the shores. The only thing that mentions anything about dead sailors and sirens in the same sentence is what Circe says, and I quote, they sit in a green field and warble men to death with the sweetness of their song. There is a great heap of dead men's bones lying all around with flesh still rotting off them. That's it. No mention of anything else. And their flesh is still on their bones. Like, are they wasteful? I don't believe a siren would be wasteful. And that's it. That's all the Odyssey says about the sirens and dead men in the same sentence. And their song as well might not be as deadly as we have been led to believe. In the Odyssey, they don't sing to kill men. They simply give them irresistible wisdom and knowledge of the future. In the Odyssey, the sirens say, O stay, O pride of Greece, Ulysses, stay. O cease thy course and listen to our lay. Blessed is the man ordained our voice to hear. The song instructs the soul and charms the ear. Approach, thy soul shall into raptures rise. Approach and learn new wisdom from the wise. We know whate'er the kings of mighty name achieved at Lyon in the field of fame. Where'er beneath the sun's bright journey lies, oh stay and learn new wisdom from the wise. Is it the wisdom that kills them? Is it the thirst for knowledge that kills them? Do they stay on this island because they know the future and are too afraid or just don't want to face it? And there are so many interpretations. It's hard to say which one is correct. But with his knowledge of the sirens told by Circes, he plans with his crew and he's able to hear the sirens' song and maybe gain this wisdom and this knowledge of the future, but also continue to sail. The moral lesson here being one must plan to resist temptation. Worldly temptation, though sweet in the moment, will never bring you glory, which is super duper important, apparently. Moral lesson after moral lesson appear in the Odyssey. But Greece and Homiwomi were not the only morality police that used the allure of an island of maidens to make their morality point.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Research for this episode surprised me in two ways. Number one, I did not realize that the island of women trope would be so full of morality lessons, air quote. And I also did not expect to find a story of actual cannibal women on an island. I was looking for other legendary women-only islands and found two Japanese mythological islands that I have to share with you. We'll start our journey on the island of Nyogyoshima. And to set the scene, I need to explain how Buddhist monks of the 11 to the 13-1400s felt about women. So according to Dr. Max Moriman, in his essay, Demonology and Eroticism, Islands of Women in the Japanese Buddhism, to the male authors of medieval Japanese Buddhist literature, the female body was an endless source of fear and fascination. Women, according to the oft-quoted sutra passage, are, quote, the emissaries of hell. They cut off forever the seed of Buddhahood, and on the outside, they have the faces of bodhisattvas, but on the inside, they have the heart of demons. So, yeah. Not a great time for the ladies, okay? These feelings toward women manifested in many real ways in society and also through Buddhist myths and legends. The story of Nyogyoshima actually first appears as a puppet show in the 1700s, which is set in the 1100s. And long story short, because it's a very long and complicated puppet show,
definitely not for kids,
the wife of a fallen warlord decides to get all the ladies on an island and use them to seduce men to create an army to fight the guy that killed her husband. So there's a lot to unpack there. There's not a lot of information about this island, however, really only this puppet show and a few ukiyo-e prints. But again, this story is used as a cautionary tale for men. However, our second island, the one with the cannibals, has a lot of information about it. And it's called Rasetsukoku. Nope. I'm sorry. It's so hard to go from English to Japanese pronunciation sometimes. Rasetsukoku, which literally translates to the country of Rasetsu. Koku just means country, which is really cool. Again, thanks to our friend Dr. Max, Rasetsukoku represented a conflicted site of desire and denial, of anxiety and alterity, a realm where the boundaries of religion and sexuality were encountered and explored. It lay forever at the margins of the known world, marking the furthest edge of cultural identity. Yet, like a floating island, it remained unfixed. It drifted both geographically and semantically until what was once a land of demons south of India was rediscovered as an erotic paradise of Japan. So what does this mean? Well, the first story of this sexy cannibal island actually comes from Sri Lanka in a story called How Sokara and the 500 Merchants Went to the Island of Rasetsu. Long, straight to the point. Love it. So in the story, Sokara and 500 merchants get lost in a storm and are shipwrecked on the island of Lasetskoku. They find a bunch of super smoking hot ladies and they're like, oh my God, this is amazing. There's a bunch of super hot ladies here, a whole bunch of food, so let's just stay here forever. Sounds great. And the merchants have a great time doing the downstairs disco, getting married to some of these women who they don't know are actually demons. But eventually, Sokara kind of gets a weird feeling. Something about the vibe is off. So he goes out exploring to do a vibe check, okay? And he goes to the edge of the island where he finds bones, dismembered body parts, and just piles of dead bodies, alongside prisons that are full of men who are very malnourished and have some of their limbs cut off. And these men in the prisons tell Sokara what is really going on this island. The prisoners tell Sokara that the Rasetsu are actually demon women, and they too were merchants who got stranded on this island, and they too married these beautiful women. But slowly, men were disappearing. But as soon as another merchant ship crash landed on the island, these men were taken to the prison and used as like a living refrigerator, which is so gross. So the prisoner warned Sokara of this fate. And Sokara returned to his men and said, oh my God, guys, we got to get off this island. And the guys were like, okay, we believe you. How are we going to get off? Because our boat is just totally effed up. We cannot sail it. Just randomly, the Bodhisattva Kanon, the goddess of mercy, heard these men and was like, oh my God, let me help you real quick. So she sent a white horse to go down to the island, a giant flying white horse. And a bunch of Sokara's men climbed onto the horse. Not all of them made it, which is sad, you know, and flew off into the sunset. They went back home to their wives, who knew none the wiser. But our story was not over. For Sokara's Rasetsu wife was a particularly powerful demon woman, and she decided that she was not done with Sokara. She went to his village, went into his room, and said, hey, hun, it's me. Come on back to the island so I can eat you. And Sokara said, absolutely not. I am now a pious man. I have found the path of Buddha once again, and I will not be tricked by you, demon woman. And she was like, wait here a minute. I'm just going to go complain to the king really quick. And that's exactly what she did. She complained to the king. And the king was like, wow, this lady is really, really sexy. Would you like to do the downstairs disco with me? And she said, of course, because this was her plan the whole time. And she went in with the king to a secluded room and they did not come out for 3 days. And when Sokara heard about this, he came rushing to the palace, but it was already too late. After the 3 days, the doors were opened, the guards walked in, the Rasetsu demon woman walked out with blood and gross little human bits all down the front of her kimono, and she left. The guards found inside the room no sign of the king, but a pile of blood and hair, which is gross. Sokara was so upset by the Rasetsu that he decided to get all of his men together and go back to the Rasetsukoku and kill all of the demon women in the name of the king and Buddha. The island needed to be cleansed. He killed all of the Rasetsu, and then he became king of that island. Sokara released himself from temptation, went to this island again after he had escaped, and cleansed it of all of its evil women with their evil sexiness. And this is the moral of the story. Not to give in to the temptation of women and stay on the path of the Buddha. That is the usual moral of the story when talking about the island of Rasetsukoku. And there are so many other stories, like the two men who on purpose went to the island because they heard about it and they were like, yes, let me get in on this. And they apparently became gentlemen of the night and helped over 1,000 Adasetsu women every day, and eventually they died. And it wasn't because of the 1,000 partners that they had on the daily. No, no, nay, nay, dear one. It was their morality that killed them. They became too immoral and they just died, which that's totally plausible. The moral of the story was, if you have too many natties, you'll die. That's it. Don't have too many natties or you will die. And stories like this go on and on, with the women always being these hellish, cannibalistic demons that hide their true selves with the facade of a beautiful woman. Although these stories might be a few thousand years old, we can still feel their impact to this day. It's impossible to know just how big of an impact these kinds of stories have had on the culture they came from and the places these stories ended up. When I began this research, I did not think that I would discover the centuries-long trope of evil women on an island being used as a cautionary tale for men to follow their moral compass. Air quotes. I thought that you and I were going to sit down and have a fun little chat about badass warrior women chilling out on an island by themselves, but nay, nay, dear one, that is not what I found at all. And I really don't know what this discovery means for me or history as a whole, but I do know that I don't like it when women are sexualized and turned into the villain for their sexuality. But I'm also glad that I know that this trope exists. And I don't remember who said it, but someone out there on the interweb said, "I'm here for women's rights, but I'm also here for women's wrongs. And I'm also here for morally gray women." So we're here for all the women. And I think, you know, so what if a few dudes get eaten for being unfaithful little dung beetles? And I'm okay with that. If you cheat on your wife with magical witches and nymphs and demon women on random islands that you come upon, then I feel like maybe you deserve to get eaten. Well, dear one, we have come to our final thought for today. And you know what? I would actually love to know what your thoughts are on this whole demon lady moral story of women on islands trope. I would love to know what you think, and I would love to know if you have any other information that you would like to add to this conversation, because I'm so excited to dig deeper into this rabbit hole with you. But for our final thought today, I wanted to kind of end on a somewhat positive note and kind of take back the idea of women-only communities being used as moral stories. Although they're not islands, there are many communities in the world that are women-only villages or towns. For example, Umoja, women cultural village in Kenya. In the 1990s, the women of the Samburu tribe created this village with only 15 women at the beginning. These women had run away from really, really terrible situations. They got no help from the government, no help from their families, and they only had each other to rely on. There was no outside support, so they decided to make this incredible community where they could live safely and happily. And they have been doing so since the 1990s. More than 30 years of this women-only village. And I'll leave more information about them in the show notes, but I wanted to add one more thing before we go today. So what these women are doing is not only creating a safe space for women, but also changing land equality for women in Kenya. As of this recording, they haven't received it yet, but they are very, very close to receiving a land grant so that they can be the legal owners of their village and neighboring farming area, which is fantastic. So I highly encourage you to go find out more about this really, really cool community. Well, dear one, thank you so much for joining me in this episode. If you're watching on YouTube, thank you for dealing with the not so great lighting and the new background. I hope it was okay for you. I hope it gave your eyes a new thing to feast on. I appreciate you being here for episode 123 of For the Love of History podcast. As always, if you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving a rating or a review. It's honestly one of the best ways to let the algorithm gods know that this podcast should be shown to other potential history BFFs. And as you know, applications are always open for the History BFF Club. If you'd like to support the podcast in other ways, you can join us over on YouTube. You can also join us over on Patreon, where we have so many cool activities. There's ad-free listening, there's early releases, there is a Shogun series that is slowly coming out because it takes a really long time to edit. We also have my book updates. We have merch discounts. We have lots of polls, lots of community. Patreon is always the first to hear about any upcoming activities or events. So it's a great place to be. And it starts out at just $2 a month, which is like less than a cup of coffee. Way less than a cup of coffee in this economy. You kidding me? And you can find links to that, of course, in the show notes. If you would like to support the podcast and rep your love for the love of history, you can get yourself some merch. I'm actually wearing Rin's right now, so it's a little bit oversized on me, but it's the only dumb question is the one we don't ask sweater, and I absolutely love it. It's so cute, so comfy. I bought it for Rin, but it's mine now. There's a bunch of other designs that you can get your cute little fingers on, and you can see some of them right here. You can also support the podcast by sharing this or any episode with somebody who you think would enjoy For the Love of History, or somebody who you think needs to love history a little bit more. Whatever you do, I appreciate you being here. I appreciate any support that you give. And with that, I will bid you adieu, tell you to do something kind for yourself. I have no hydration on the table with me right now. It's awful. I'm gonna go get water as soon as I'm done recording. So don't forget to drink water. Do something kind for yourself. Go outside and touch some grass. And I will see you next week for the fourth anniversary of For the Love of History podcast live recording. I'm so excited. Okay, I'll see you later. Love you, bye.
Why is there a metronome right now? Okay.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.